Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Andrew Bezovich is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. He's also a former Army colonel who served in Vietnam. He often joins us here as a military analyst. But today we want to talk to him about this political moment. His recent essay at tomdispatch.com, we'll post it at hereandnow.org, is titled Slouching Toward Mar-a-Lago. It is more about this particular moment. It's more about how we got here, and it doesn't spare. Both parties, he says, are led by aging hacks. The U.S. has long become a monarchy, and while our emperor tweets, Rome itself fiddles. He says we shouldn't spend so much time worrying about the man in the White House. We should be worrying about the culture, the society, the people who put him there. Trump is not cause, but consequence. And Andrew Bezovich joins us in the studio. Provocative as always. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You say cause, not consequence, but look first at Charlottesville. President Trump's critics would say he is cause, that the hate groups that gathered there, giving the Nazi salute without any fear, chortling gleefully on social media after the president spoke and made his first comments and did not condemn them. They noted that. The president said, I love everyone. They took that to mean he loves them, that they were emboldened to even have that rally because of President Trump.
But racism pre-exists the Trump administration. We had horrific episodes, manifestations of hatred when President Obama was in the White House.
Some of them backed and fueled by
then
non-President Donald Trump.
So, I mean, I think there's no question that this president has helped to create an environment which is more conducive, which brings these people out of the woodwork. Helps their cause, but he did not create the problem. And then the burden of the argument that I'm trying to make in that essay that you cited is that I think we err when we obsess about the president.
President Trump.
About President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Because in doing that, we lose sight of the factors that created the conditions that allowed him to become president in the first place. I mean, I would endorse all of the criticisms that have been made, that are made, of President Trump on a daily basis, that he's a dissembler, that he's a narcissist, that he's uneducated, that he's uninterested in becoming educated, that he's temperamental, that he lacks judgment. And it's a travesty that he has become the president of the United States. But one gets a sense, as I try to monitor the debate, one gets a sense that the people who oppose Trump think that if we could just goad Trump into resigning tomorrow, that by the day after tomorrow, everything would be hunky-dory. And I think that's not the case.
Well, because you make the case that while those in the anti-Trump resistance, as you call it, have made the resistance the big story. The big story is actually, have I got this right, that for a couple of decades now, we have made the president of the United States an outsized character that previously, except for one or two, FDR comes to mind, we just didn't do.
That's part of the argument I'm making. And therefore, when we end up with a character like Donald Trump, we are all appalled. But the broader—
Well, we aren't all appalled.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, right.
Fair enough.
Because some see him.
Tens of millions of people were not appalled.
No, but I think that's part of your point, that there is a part of the electorate that is saying, well, what's wrong with that? Because Bill Clinton was a huge outsized character who played saxophone, and there was sort of this shimmer of celebrity around him, too.
But the people who voted for him, in my judgment, voted for him. I want to say this carefully, for what they consider to be good reasons. That is to say, as Trump supporters viewed the direction of the country, I think particularly since the end of the Cold War, and assessed the ideas, the principles that seemed to be guiding the direction of the country, they said, hey, these aren't working for me. And his genius, if you want to call it that, was being able by 2016 and be able to tap that collective animosity and to bring these people into the voting booth to cast votes for him. But and my point here is that what deserves more attention than I believe it's getting is what the heck are those ideas? Mm-hmm. What course did we follow? We the country, in the wake of the Cold War, this moment of great victory, this moment when, in a famous article, Francis Fukuyama said we had reached the end of history, when all the basic problems of humankind had supposedly been resolved. What happened after that? And I think what happened after that is the country went deeply wrong. And in some senses, the election of Donald Trump is a reflection of a growing awareness that the country had gone wrong. So that's not an endorsement of Donald Trump. Really, it's simply an appeal to say, let the conditions that created him deserve far more attention than they have been getting.
And they are what? I mean, you say it's the ideas.
All right.
Stupid.
So are the ideas?
Yeah.
I mean, my hypothesis is that idea number one is that globalization was going to bring us to some kind of a collective utopia, that globalization, in given its capacity, globalization really shorthand for corporate capitalism, American-style corporate capitalism on a planetary scale, that was going to create so much wealth that it was going to be a problem solver. Well, it turned out that it did create great wealth and left a whole lot of people behind and hurting and disenchanted. So globalization didn't live up to its promises. Second idea, I think, was the notion that the United States was going to continue to be the great leader of the world and that the availability of superior American military power was the instrument whereby we would maintain peace, harmony, and our preeminence. And that has led us, in my judgment, to a series of pretty stupid wars, unsuccessful wars, costly wars, with no end in sight.
And of course,
Trump promised that there would be an end, but of course, now that he's president, there's still no end.
Well, and I have to note, for those who may not have heard you on our program before, that you know you lost a son in one of those wars, and so this is something that you have followed very closely. But the third is this idea of muscular global leadership by the U.S.
That's what I was referring to.
Yeah,
I mean, because it takes a military form. The third idea, and this is the one that, candidly, I have the hardest time articulating, is the conception of individual freedom that we collectively have embraced. And I'll say it in blunt terms that many people will disagree with, but it seems to me that increasingly, and I think the end of the Cold War is sort of a rough date for when this tendency matures, and that is that we've abandoned sort of the traditional Judeo-Christian rooted notions of how we are to behave. And we collectively, many of us, have embraced the notion that there should be no limits on the exercise of personal freedom.
Give me an example.
Well, I think that the example is particularly evident in the whole realm of sexuality and gender relations. And I don't want to sound like I'm sort of somehow against all this. What I do argue is that the expectations of those who have promoted this broader conception of freedom have not yielded happiness, solidarity, a collective sense of being engaged as people, as Americans, in some kind of an enterprise that we are all committed to. I mean, when I look at at our country, opioid addictions, epidemics of obesity, epidemics of porn, these are not indications of a healthy society. Mm. So we have more freedom today as individuals than we ever have had but something ain't right.
Well, look, you have a 10-point plan to fix it. We have 90 seconds. So, you know, you have a lot of, in your prescription, abolish the Electoral College, roll back gerrymandering, limit the impact of corporate money on elections, mandate a balanced federal budget. We'll post everything at tiernow.org.
That's not my argument for how to fix it.
Exactly.
It's my argument for let's clear away some of the debris that has accumulated since the end of the Cold War that gets in the way. I don't have a recipe for how to fix it. I believe that I see myself as a conservative. I think principled conservatives have things to say in this with regard to this issue. I strongly believe that principled progressives have things to say, and we need to have a debate. You know, the core question of the debate is, what is the definition of the common good in America in the 21st century? We need an answer to that question.
You know what? I'm going to throw that out to listeners. What makes an American? As you say, for a long time, an American was someone who fought the Soviets. That's right. What defined Americans in the Cold War. With that gone, what is an American? Herenow.org. Andrew Bacevich, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at BU. Thank you so much. We'll post your article at tomdispatch.com. We've barely scratched the surface, but it's a good scratch. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.